and let him go. Karata backed away, off to hide in the darkness with his master.
I feel safer already, said Drover,
and Morgravia scowled. Only the barkeep and the singer in black were left, as well as the two courtesans and Drover.
Can she be moved? Morgravia indicated the singer.
Jaina, my wife, said the barkeep.
Can she be moved?
He shook his head.
Her leg, she's injured.
I'll stay,
said one of the courtesans. Morgravia noticed the other one staring into the darkness and recognised shock when she saw it.
Then stay down and hope they come to us.
The cage buckled again. It shook, wrenched back and forth, twisting and creaking, the thin metal barrier between life and something worse than death.
I don't know about you, she said to Drover, but I'd rather die on my feet.
I'd sooner not die at all, he replied.
But since that's not on the table, the barkeep was up too. He'd found a heavy-looking mace from some concealed alcove or other. It looked regulation issue.
Shockmore, said Morgravia, as the three of them took position almost shoulder to shoulder on the lookout for where the cage would surrender first.
You were a lawman.
Barak, said the barkeep, I'm an ex-proctor.
He nodded to the shotgun.
That's from back in the day too.
Morgravia gave him a rueful smile.
All hail the Lex.
Barak thumped his fist against his chest in an old salute. The flare of the shockmore cast a dull, crackling glow as it activated. Drover looked down at his punch dagger.
I won't deny I'm experiencing some serious notions of inadequacy at this moment.
Have no fear,
Morgravia replied, her eyes on the pallid, their hordes pushing and reaching.
The Emperor protects.
Drover's colourful expletive was drowned out by the sound of the cage bending and snapping as a welter of bodies tumbled in. The shotgun boomed, loud as artillery fire. It bucked in Morgravia's grip, kicking like a punch to the shoulder. Muzzle flame flared, magnesium bright. Faces and bodies disintegrated, reduced to mist and offal. Something burned, a pallid with its hair alight, cooking in its own wretched skin. The smell of ozone and heat arose as Barak lit up another. He had the maul on maximum discharge. It was practically a flaming brand. In the snatches between the thunderous retorts of the shotgun, Morgravia saw Drover. He fought behind a rampart of bodies, killing with a pit fighter's ferocity, his face a mask of blood.
Not enough, thought Morgravia, as the pallid kept coming, their numbers endless.
Not enough, as the shotgun fed its last round into the breach. Hand to hand, they would quickly be overrun. Her senses slowed, the last seconds stretching like time smeared across the pain of her existence. Sound distorted, robbed of its clarity. She tasted blood and smelled the actinic bite of another place. The red dream came again, uncaring of its inconvenience. And as she fell and the pain needles took their due, Morgravia looked up into the rafters at an arachnoid shape descending, silver fangs glinting, poised for the kill. Then the dream took her.
Hot blades swerving, bearing, dissecting organs heaped upon a slab, clicking, whirring, the tools descending, bone yielding, cracking, snapping the stink of burning fusion, melding, made and unmade, metal and rods and sinew and muscle skin, burning, cold, dark, warm, bright, the throb of the machine, droning, chirping, a long chime, stretching on into forever, dying, dying, endlessly dying, the loop unbroken, as two red suns loom over red, red, red.
A flash of captured silver brought her back. The bar had partly collapsed as the mesh had been wrenched away, and she stared through a canyon of splintered wood at the darkness.
It was a sword she had seen, held by a shadow, dark against light. A second joined the first, two long, arching blades, snapping with serpentine quickness, wielded in tandem, scything and reaping. They severed hands and scalps and legs and torsos. They impaled and cleaved and sheared. Hell had arrived for the pallid in more ways than one, and it wore the face of death. She sprang like a clockwork thing, but with a dancer's grace, fluid and syncopated at the same time. A heel turn, a pirouette. No pallid could touch her, but she went through their fetid ranks like a threshing machine, night black and deadly. She moved across the floor, the walls, the ceiling, as if the laws of physics and gravity did not apply to her, slashing and weaving, her swords like silver lightning. Morgravia groaned, late as usual, and felt a soft hand stroke her calloused grip. She turned to see one of the courtesans, her face pale white, but with a reddish rose colour around the eyes. Morgravia released her, tried to stand, stumbled, snarled a refusal of help, and then stood upright on the second attempt. The cage had come down, torn right off its hinges, and hung slack like a broken jaw. Bodies were trapped beneath it, within it, snagged where they'd tried to reach through the mesh. All were unmoving, dismembered or beheaded. Barak sagged against the bar, exhausted. Drover was wiping his punch dagger on a grimy trouser leg. He had a wild, faraway look in his eyes and didn't meet Morgravia's gaze at first. When he did, he just stared, the blood spattering his face like war paint. The others lived, the singer in black and the other courtesan, though she remained hunched up below the bar and had not broken eye contact with the shadows there. Morgravia wondered if there was much of her left beyond the shell she still possessed. Every pallid was slain, disassembled. An abattoir stench pervaded, the charnel devastation all too apparent. In the midst of it stood a slight figure, a girl really, though she had ceased to be that for some time, if she ever really was one. Morgravia felt a pang of something lost as she regarded her. This leather-clad assassin, as bloody as any corpse, staring from behind the hollows of a grinning skull. Hell slid her blades back into their scabbards.
"Hello, mother," she uttered pleasantly. "Did you miss me?"
Chapter 10. Relentless. Wearily, they trudged through Meager. At first, Christo had insisted they keep to the side alleys and narrower streets, the ones less travelled. He need not have concerned himself. The town was deserted, its districts ominously silent, its commercia and habitats empty, as if they had all been abandoned at the same time. It was as if some unknown signal had gone out, and now everyone was simply gone. Scraps of parchment, fluttering strips of torn fabric and propaganda leaflets scampered across the main street, pushed and pulled by the breeze. Somewhere, a recycle fan turned, its lazy revolutions an eerie drone that put Christo on edge. He glanced at Celestia. She clung to the sword, gazing up at the high buildings, at the squalor and the dilapidation. She hadn't spoken since they had fled the agri-fields. Nor had he. The memory of the machine ever at the edge of his mind. He had seen servitors before. The cyborganic creatures that fulfilled the labours at the bullet farm that no mortal could endure. But that stalk-legged thing, the red eyes strafing, it had been made to hunt and would have killed them both had it not been called away.
"It is a grimy place,"
Celestia observed, pulling him from his thoughts.
"Can't argue there,"
Christo replied, glad of the distraction.
It's not usually this quiet. You've never seen Meager before.
She shook her head.
I have never left the Priory.
Ever? How did you come to serve the church?
My sisters,
she faltered, biting her lip to contain her grief.
They took me in as a baby and raised me in their ways and beliefs. My aptitudes lay in healing, and so they tutored me also.
I'm sorry.
I have no regrets. I yearned for nothing more than the opportunity to serve him and to heal others.
No,
said Christo, realizing she had misunderstood.
I meant, I'm sorry you lost them. Your sisters.
Celestia's face darkened, and she replied in a small voice.
As am I.
She looked up at him, tears brimming in her eyes, but her emotions held in check.
Thank you for saying that. You are a good man.
Christo gave a mirthless laugh.
I have sin enough for two lifetimes. If you knew what I had done, you would not think of me so favourably.
He paused, considering the right words.
I want to atone. I want to be better.
Celestia gestured to Corinna. For your daughter. Christo nodded and cast a fearful glance in her direction.
She's all that matters now.
Celestia smiled, and for a moment she seemed older than her years, the teachings of her order aging her artificially.
I do not know what you've done, Christo, these sins you speak of. I only see what is before me, and that is not an impious man.
Christo bowed his head, feeling unworthy of her absolution. He belonged here, amongst the filth and the rot, he knew that. Though the people had disappeared, the stench would always remain, the eye-watering reek of effluence that stuck to clothes and refused to depart. Blood scent coloured the air now too, so thickly that a great quantity of it had to have been spilled. But Christo saw no bodies. He saw a few weapons here and there, a discarded riot shield. No one alive, though. No one dead, either. He was wondering why that was, when he felt a sort of low throb that hurt his ears. Then came a stirring of the air, a faint susurration of a distant disturbance. Celestia heard it too, and turned to him, her eyes wide as silver coins. Grasping her wrist, he pulled her into a parchment maker's, the wares scattered around a dingy chamber and trailing unkemptly out of the open door. Bloody footprints marked a few of the pages, mixed with the smeared ink and dirt, and he wondered where the person who they belonged to had gone. They crouched down, Christo still holding on to Corinna and listening, trying to discern where the sound was coming from.
What is it?
Hissed the sister novice before Christo pressed a finger to his lips, indicating that they should stay quiet. He remembered those killing edges again and that cold regard. If the machine they had met earlier stalked the town. Christo suddenly wished he'd stopped to pick up one of the weapons he'd seen lying around. Then he quickly dismissed the idea. There would be no fighting something like that. The only chance they had would be to stay hidden. But it wasn't the machine. It was something else. Maybe something worse. He knew it with all the gut-wrenching certainty of a man who can't escape his fate, who is destined to face the penance he is due. He almost sank then, down to his knees, ready to accept, to relent at last. Then he closed his eyes, clenching them tight, and thought of Corinna, in those days gone, of the daughter he still owed, and the girl crouched nearby he had sworn to himself to protect. I want to atone. His own words returned to judge him. They would not stop coming. They had no pity, no remorse. Christo opened his eyes, ready to bear his burdens again. Find the strength. Be like them. Never yield. Not until she's safe. Until they're both safe. Then you can stop. Then you'll be done. He met Celestia's scared gaze and reached out to grip her small hand in his.
We have to run.
The dead had returned. And they were coming. Chapter 11. Plague. Barak disliked most people. He found them shallow and likely to disappoint. But he would miss Verin. He had been an ostentatious character in life, fond of jewelled rings and fine attire, at least as fine as he could afford, and the jewels were really just cut glass. Fake emeralds had been his favourite. Still, it gave him an air. Barak smiled sadly at the memory his thoughts provoked.
Damn theremin, he murmured,
surprised at the thickness of his voice. The instrument had emerged unscathed and intact, which was more than could be said for poor Verin himself. During the initial surge, he had saved Jaina, and Barak would be ever grateful for that sacrifice. He had wanted to bury him, but not enough remained to give to the earth. And as he hunted around the shed attached to his bar, he realised he didn't own a shovel anyway. The blanket he had wrapped Verin in would have to suffice instead, as it had for the others, until they were all burned.
Is it still here? Asked a quiet, hardened voice.
He nodded, not needing to turn around to identify the speaker. He'd known she'd want to see the mule as soon as he'd mentioned he still had it. Barak worried she might sanction him, but he suspected they were beyond all of that.
Are you really one of them? He asked. A woman?
Barak chuckled, appreciating the effort at levity.
Well, that answers one question, he said,
his old hands finding the edge of a dusty tarp. It felt coarse against his fingers.
They don't bleed you of humour, at least.
Oh no, they let us keep that. It helps when faced with the abyss.
I should think it does, said Barak, hauling on the tarp, pulling it back and away.
A small dust cloud kicked up, and he coughed, waving his arm back and forth to help clear it.
Been a long while since I took her out.
We'll need it.
No way we'll get out of here on foot.
The chains and clamps were still in place. Barak needed keys, and they were back in the bar. He didn't relish the thought of returning there. It was why he left in the first place, when everyone else was still afraid to. Apart from her, of course. And the other one. He tried not to think about the one in black, grinning like death.
Will it run? Asked Morgravia.
He faced the Inquisitor. He caught an inkling they weren't alone, and he found he had a sudden desire to leave.
She'll have to.
Barak departed, leaving Morgravia alone to her thoughts, at least for a short while.
I can feel you watching me, you know, she said, and stepped away from the shed.
Hel emerged from the shadows, poised like a dancer. Her head canted one way, then the other, jerky and avian.
Are you angry with me, Mother?
I asked you not to call me that, said Morgravia sternly. And no, I'm not angry. You saved my life. You saved several lives.
If that registered on any sort of emotional level, Hel didn't show it. She had been well indoctrinated. A blunt blade honed into a killing weapon by the Sanguinous. Morgravia wondered if she'd had a part in that, handing a child into the hands of a death cult to be hollowed out and shaped into something lethal. She supposed she must have.
Is this a part of it? The reason why we are here?
Asked Hel. Morgravia thought on that a moment, and decided that it probably was. What did you find?
It is bad, my lord. The plague has taken the town. Many are infected.
Infected how?
Unknown. The contagion affected masses at once, entire districts.
Spores? A chemical attack? Morgravia considered. No, it can't be the air. We would have felt its effects and been turned ourselves. Blood or saliva, a biological toxin. That wouldn't explain the mass infections. She ran through the probabilities aloud, collating what she could remember. The Ordo Sepulturum had a particular interest and efficacy in dealing with what had been termed plagues of unbelief, the miraculous and horrific rising of the dead. Chaos taint, the belief in old infernal gods and the rejection of the imperial creed was a supposed catalyst. A corruption of the faith as well as the body. In this case, the symptoms did not match the disease. The pallid were alive, at least at first. This was different. Without the expertise of a Magos biologist or even a sanctioned chirurgeon, she could only postulate. And the other matter? She asked. Have you found any sign?
They remain clandestine.
It must be connected.
I agree.
A mild spike of pain had Morgravia pinching the bridge of her nose and shutting her eyes to ward it off.
The malady?
Asked Hel. Morgravia nodded. Still here. Ignore it. This is nothing.
Has it worsened?
Morgravia paused, but saw no need to dissemble. Yes.
Perhaps it is connected too.
Thought had crossed my mind. The pain ebbed, and Morgravia opened her eyes again. She regarded Hel. Why did you return? Although the rictus of her skull mask remained fixed, the slight angle of Hel's head gave it the impression of confusion. Her voice sounded hurt.
You needed me.
But how, Hel? How did you know I was in trouble? The head twitched again, jerky like before, an expression of incredulity.
I think I felt it.
Morgravia frowned, walking past her to appraise the darkened town, wondering if Hel was in fact a latent psyker. But the idea didn't resonate, despite the ambiguity of her fractured memory. It was quiet out in the beyond, deathly so. Meager had become a tomb, fit only for the dead. Morgravia stared down the darkness. They had waited here long enough.
Have I disappointed you?
Asked the assassin, interrupting her thoughts. Morgravia shook her head. She caught a whiff of Hel's odour near to her, the scent of charnel houses, the sweat of exertion. For a moment, she had the distinct impression that the assassin might be reaching out to touch her or leaning in to smell her. It's just another unanswered question. She turned, but Hel remained as she had been, having adopted a coy, almost childlike mien. This is escalating. I need answers.
Did you meet with the broker? Can we trust her?
The datasmith had yet to tell her where she would find the empath. Given the current state of things, Morgravia supposed she could be forgiven for abandoning the idea in favour of self-preservation, but she needed her mind back. It mattered. She knew this much. Some small ember of urgency flared at the thought, a memory still without form, though the importance of its recovery impressed itself upon her. Almost certainly not, but she's desperate enough to deal. That's longer term. I need an edge, now. Something that gets us closer.
Am I to hunt?
Morgravia considered it. Having Hel by her side yielded obvious advantages, but the assassin made her uneasy, and finding the ones hunting her had become a priority. A slow nod saw Hel disappear back into the dark. Chapter 12. No choice left. The dead lay heaped in front of the bar, right where Barak had left them. foolish to think they would do anything other than simply be. But he had seen things very recently that had put his mortal preconceptions to the question. In any event, they were still there, bodies entangled with bodies, human and inhuman alike. The sight of it appalled Barak, but served as a stark reminder of watching as his two hefty servitors hauled out the corpses. He and Drover had found Verin and the others, who had become part of the horde. It didn't feel right to let the servitors take them. They were lumbering, indelicate things, prone to shoveling the bodies, mass piles of them and their constituent parts, pushing them out into the street to fester. Barak picked up what was left of Verin, weeping as he did so, not just for the man, but for everything he had lost, for what might become of Jaina. It was bitter to think that Verin's sacrifice might have merely forestalled the inevitable. It was grim work, and the smell would linger on long after. It had to be done, though, to leaven the smell inside, if nothing else. The bodies would have to be burned. He wanted to burn his clothes, too, but he had no spares. Fear had kept the pyre unlit, fear of what the smoke or fire might bring. The night harboured a threat Barak could not see but knew was there. A disconcerting quiet had descended over the town, and he stood upon his stoop, listening to it. He lit a stick of tobacco and was taking a deep draw to steady his nerves when he saw the light. Bright and crimson, it coloured the sky as far as he could see, before fading back into darkness. Barak moved down off the stoop, squinting for the light. It returned, as vibrant as before, red ink distilled in water, a blood drop expanding, reddening the clouds. Barak winced as a shriek split the night, so loud, so appallingly loud after the silence. It ended as abruptly as it had begun, and then, faintly, barely audible despite the returning stillness, and therefore distant, there came a rumble. Barak imagined churned earth, the cracking of stone. Digging. He doubted the mining consortiums of Low Sink would be operating. Their owners would have fled up Hive by now to escape the terror. Raised voices emanated from within the bar, briefly arresting Barak's attention, as the others argued around their petty agendas. Tension lingered in the air like an uninvited guest. Death roamed meagre. For now, its shadow had moved on, but it was still out there somewhere, amidst the ghost town of empty buildings and silent streets. The light did not return a third time. A glint of metal caught his eye instead. It came from a ringed finger, the hand it belonged to, curled by death into a claw. It had flopped out from beneath its rough shawl, the gem upon the band a vivid green. Deciding he had been out on the stoop long enough, Barak returned to the bar. The stench of blood and decay remained. It was over. Barak knew that. Assuming he survived whatever followed, Hallow's End would not. Had not. It bore a taint, something foul and as indelible as memory that could never be removed. It had endured fire and flood, gang war and taxation, but not this. Whatever this was had ended it. Jaina was where he had left her, resting in a leather-backed chair in one of the booths. She slept fitfully, Maella by her side, gently holding her hand. Barak nodded to her as he crossed the threshold, and she smiled back, mustering a grace he had, to his shame, thought a courtesan slaved to Farkum incapable of. He gave a furtive glance to the shadows at the periphery of the room, relieved to find the morbid effigy still absent. She had exuded menace, that assassin, intentionally or not. He had seen what she had done to the pallid, and wasn't ashamed to admit it scared the shit out of him. He had met killers. He had put some of them away, and others in the dirt. In Low Hive, mankind's many depredations found expression. But he had never encountered anyone like that, so uniquely disposed to the art of killing. So although the assassin had departed, Barak stayed alert, like a man who has lost track of a wild beast but knows it could return at any moment. A few of the others had gathered around a table, one still left more or less in one piece. Earlier, Barak had found some old sodium lamps in the storeroom, and their flickering glow illuminated an old, waxy map Drover had weighed down with coins and tankards. They had all become acquainted in the short time after, exchanging names and sometimes greetings, as if any of that really mattered any more. Mankind will find comforts where it may, he supposed, and approached the table.
Getting to the precinct house won't be easy, Drover was saying. This road, he pointed to the map, tracing a gloved finger down the map, is the most direct route, but that makes it the busiest. The place is a fortress. No way it's been breached. He looked up as Barak stepped up. Let's hope your old comrades are in a charitable mood and open up for us. I can get them to open the gate, said Barak, with more confidence than he felt.
He would have to trade on his old alliances, and even then he couldn't seriously vouch for everyone in the room, as long as he and Jaina were safe. Another agenda, he thought. I'm no better than the rest of them.
The precinct district had a walled border dividing it from the rest of Low Hive, handy in the event of a block riot or a gang war. A single high-sided gate was the only way in. Two guard towers manned by snipers and auto-turrets maintained overwatch. A kill box extended outwards from the wall for over 150 feet. Drover regarded Barak keenly, as if measuring the truth in his words.
Then I feel better already, he said,
the smile he gave not reaching his eyes. Farkum barked something in his native tongue. Apparently he had tired of speaking Gothic. He sat at a remove from the others, resting against the wall, sweating and drinking. The manservant, Karata, stood close and translated for his master.
Our business is not with the proctors.
Drover leaned back to put his booted feet up onto the table, one after the other, and crossed them.
Anyone would think you're avoiding the upholders of the Lex.
Do you trust them?
Asked Karata.
That's hardly the point, is it? I don't trust you.
Then he gestured to Farkum, who was muttering something to himself. Or at least, that's how it appeared.
And I really don't trust him. But there's no staying here for any of us.
Farkum scoffed, deigning to speak.
I have no business with proctors, he said.
Nor do I,
said the broker, who sat opposite Drover, the epitome of poise and studied neutrality. She and Farkum shared a glance, and Barak sensed a deal had been made between them. This crisis could be over in hours, days. It might already be.
If you truly believed that, you'd have already left, Drover replied.
Remember who is paying you, the broker said. The threat more than implied.
Drover appeared unconcerned.
Your coin buys my gun arm, not my free will.
He flicked a glance at the sommelier standing behind her. It looked nondescript enough, but he evidently knew better. The broker didn't press the issue.
Regardless, I need the Inquisitor before I leave, she countered. I am still owed.
A debt I swore would be paid in full, said Morgravia, having overheard everything.
She stopped in the doorway. They had raised the blast door manually, using a crank located in the storeroom, and the wan light from outside framed her imposing silhouette.
It will be,
she promised, moving inside. She looked pale, almost haunted, and Barak wondered if the abyss she had spoken of earlier had begun to show its toll. He hadn't forgotten her collapsing during the fight, but had chosen not to mention it.
But we can't stay here any longer, said Morgravia. Miga is without power, maybe all of Low Sink. It is also seemingly without order. Whether this crisis has abated or not, a different one will have arisen to replace it, or complicate it further. The precinct house is close. It has troops and weapons. We have discussed this.
In actual fact, you declared it, said the broker.
Morgravia pressed on, ignoring the discontent.
We head there, find out what the proctors know. If you want to leave after that, no one will stop you. The broker bowed her acquiescence, but Barak didn't think she looked placated.
You, Inquisitor,
uttered the fat merchant, sweaty and dishevelled. He inflected the word so it sounded like an expletive rather than a form of address. Contempt tightened the Inquisitor's face.
What is all of this?
He gestured to the blood and the strings of viscera still gumming up the partly sealed blast door.
Shit!
He sneered at Morgravia, and she returned the sentiment, her eyes narrowing to knife slits. Beyond your understanding, she said. Barak could see Farkoum rooting through the shadows with his eyes, trying to determine if the assassin was still nearby. He wondered what the merchant was thinking, if, via his hired gun, he would be bold enough to try anything. He looked scared, and scared men were prone to making poor decisions.
I've seen something like this before, Drover cut in, forestalling the need for violence. Out in the Erds. Called it the Ravening. Beasts eating beasts, foaming, raging, messy. Never heard of it being passed on to humans, though.
Ravening, thought Barak. Always such colourful names. You might be thinking about getting out of Low Hive, said Morgravia, apparently uninterested in whatever bestial ague Drover had encountered in his past. A sane idea, but the border gate is several districts away, and I can vouch for what's between here and there. Even assuming the Magtrans still functions, and that's a large ask, it's a distance. She met Barak's gaze, and he imagined she must have seen it falter when he realised Morgravia alluded to the possibility of Jaina never surviving such a journey. Precinct House is reachable, and it's about the only safe haven left. Farkoum muttered something to Karata, the hired gun smiling coldly. Barak didn't trust them and wondered how long the fragile alliance between the survivors would last. A barked invective then saw the courtesans scurrying to the fat merchant's side. Maella sent a furtive glance to Barak, who nodded by way of silent gratitude. Drover swung his feet off the table and stood.
It's decided, then, he said,
flashing an adder's smile at Barak.
We impose upon the lawmen and hope they have kind hearts and a lot of fucking guns.
The throaty growl of an engine had presaged the arrival of the mule. Drover had made some comment about its reliability, suggesting the vehicle was less than fit for purpose and should perhaps be sold off for parts. But it ran, and it looked tough. It was a rig, an armoured truck, ostensibly used for riot suppression. Its flanks were shielded by metal plates, its hood fitted with a triangular dozer blade. Heavy, chained tyres tore up the ground, ripping furrows in the dirt as it came to a halt, and a pair of cowled lamps at the front cut through the dark like lances. A ladder unfolded down from the cabin to the ground. The cabin itself had enough room for six, two sitting up front and four behind. A flatbed trailer mounted onto the vehicle's chassis could take more. Barak drove, familiar with the vehicle's operation. The broker sat next to him. Farkoum took up two seats in the back, the others going to Jaina and Maella. The merchant didn't much like being estranged from his hired gun, nor did Karata for that matter, but there was little choice. Morgravia stood up in the trailer, hands braced against the lipped edge. An acrid scent thronged the air, and as they got underway, she followed the trailing smoke. A fire burned. It had spread to the stoop, then crept further until the frontage of the bar crackled with flames. It was voracious, devouring bone and flesh. It ran rampant through old timber, catching on scraps of parchment and cloth. It rose up like a dark beacon, pluming with oily black clouds. Vortices of ash spiralled upwards, churning, growing. The breeze turned thick with the reek of pig fat, though it wasn't pig, but crackled and spat just the same. A thunderous boom resounded as the fire reached the alcohol and it cooked off.
Damn,
Drover murmured,
holding up a hand to ward off the heat and the glare of the fire. Rain was falling. It hissed against the flames, a reaction of the mild toxins in the water. As the distance grew and the sight of Hallow's End became less and less distinct, Morgravia watched in silence as the two servitors they had left behind lit up. They stood like sentinels, unmoved by pain, unconcerned by the fire consuming them. As their sinews and wires blackened away, one of the servitors collapsed to its knees and then plunged forwards. Its skin was burning. The other followed swiftly afterwards, just two more bodies for the pyre. The smoke billowed, drifting until it cloaked the bar from sight. Chapter 13. Hollow. The rain felt good against Christo's skin. It vented from the upper strata of the hive and possessed low-level alkalinity, a product of atmospheric compressors and colossal air filtration. The rich would breathe clean, pure air, with all its harmful elements extracted, while the working poor would make do with less. At least it was cooling and kept him awake. Fatigue gnawed at his body, his muscles ached, his limbs dragged as he walked, and he didn't dare put Corinna down for fear he wouldn't be able to pick her up again. Such was the stiffness in his arms. They had fled through Meager, dead-legged, pushing on through raw adrenaline and terror. The town was abandoned, offering nothing but silence and the slow creak of vendor signs or the scuttle of refuse stirring in the breeze. It was quiet enough to hear the approach of the horde, slower than before, though they had yet to see it, its feral groaning more laboured. That, and that alone, had given them the slightest of chances to reach Hallow's End. Christo stumbled, then righted himself, belatedly noticing Celestia standing by his side. She had sheathed the sword and wrapped both her arms around Christo's thick bicep to help keep him on his feet. He nodded, too tired to speak, and held up his face to the alkali rain, unconcerned by the gentle stinging against his skin.
"How far?"
Her voice came out a weakened rasp. "Close," thought Christo. "I hope it's close." Then he smelled the ash and soot on the air.
"God, Emperor, no!"
he croaked and tried to run. He staggered, stride leaden, hot agony searing through his limbs. Celestia staggered with him, half pushing, half dragged, her own reserves of strength way past the red line. She gasped, a starved breath, a grunt of pain. Then came the end of hope. Emerging from an alleyway, Christo stopped dead. Unprepared for the abrupt halt, Celestia bundled into him. The rain had doused much of the fire. It crackled in embers now, but must once have raged like an inferno. Hallow's End was gone. It had simply ceased to be, and in its place remained a shadow, a hollow and burnt-out shell. Blackened timbers reached up, splintered like broken bones, soot smeared and funereal. The stone and metal had endured, though both were cracked and warped by heat. Christo staggered on. He felt Celestia's arms untether from his own and heard the dull thud of her body as she crumpled to the ground. He took another step, two more, the fire-gouged ruin almost goading him. He came upon two bodies at the periphery, the corroded machine parts amongst their bones revealing them as servitors. Christo passed them. He still had Corinna in his arms, unable, unwilling, to put her down. She stirred then, coughing from the smoke that lingered throughout the devastation. It curled, grey and black, phantasmal in the falling rain.
"Father."
He didn't hear her at first, and took another step. A piece of roof bent underfoot, raising a metallic din. A fallen beam cracked, nothing left to it but charcoal. And there were bodies. Not just those out front, or in the conglomerated heap still gently simmering. These were inside.
"Father."
Bits of skulls, teeth, a skeletal hand, pieces disparate from their concomitant bodies.
Father!
Christo looked down.
Corinna!
And felt the strength leave his limbs entirely. He sank knee-deep in the ash, his daughter detaching herself from his grasp to leave the burden. She stood, unsteadily, touching the dried blood on her head. Any disorientation she might have felt fled in the face of her father's near expiration. Christo fell down on one hand, and Corinna fell too, moving with him to hold him steady.
It's Hallow's End,
he rasped.
It's Barrack's old place.
Corinna looked around, disbelieving. She knew this place. Her father had drunk at Hallow's End, she just a girl in his shadow, listening to Jaina and Verin playing on the stage. It had been the only peace they had ever known. But things had changed. She had changed, no longer content to sit in her father's shadow, unwilling to submit to the endless toil of the bullet farms. That life had taken her mother and ruined her father. She vowed it would not take her. But what kind of choice was there between the grind and the gangs? She was as disorientated then as she was now.
I can't, she said, trying to piece together her present and reconcile it with the most recent past she remembered. What's happening?
Her gaze alighted on Celestia, lying prone in the street.
Who is that?
Holy sister.
Corinna's gaze snapped back to him, incredulous.
A what?
Christo shook his head, too tired to give an explanation.
Is she?
Asked Corinna.
I don't know.
Did you?
No.
He was broken, beaten, a strong man laid low, and he needed her.
Throne,
Corinna wept, whispering,
Dad.
A decade rolled back like the recoiling of the tide, all those years washed away, and all it took was for him to die.
I'm sorry,
Christo rasped,
for all of it. I never wanted any of this for you.
He slumped forwards like so much dead weight, and Corinna hadn't the strength to keep him upright. Christo felt the kiss of wet ash and let its scent fill his nostrils, let its blackness smear his skin. He wanted to rise, to fight. He could feel the dead approaching, detect their voices and half-heard susurrations scratching on the wind. You have to run, he tried to say, but could only gasp, his mouth opening and closing in impotent frustration. Darkness crowded his sight, beginning at the edges and creeping inwards. He kept his gaze on Corinna, her face, his daughter's face, fraught with worry for a father who had failed her in life, the bond between them perhaps restored, but which he would never know again. Cruel that it should happen now, at the end. He should have been better. He wished he had been better. Then Christo shut his eyes, and the darkness became absolute. Chapter 14. Hate Red. The roads through Miga were empty, the town and the district apparently deserted. No crowds bustled, no vendors hawked their wares. Even the preachers of the imperial faith had been silenced. Debris from collapsed buildings littered the streets, fires faintly guttering in their burnt-out remains. A makeshift stockade had fallen, as if sacked by an attacker, its barricades rent and torn down. The detritus of the riots lay everywhere and was widespread. A stampede had come through here, and it had left the remnants of humble lives in its wake, a scribe's broken quill, a few scattered coins, a shoe without its owner. The mule crushed everything under its heavy tread, relentless and inexorable. Rubble parted before its dozer blade. Old standing barricades were flattened. The ride was dulcet enough, the trailer rattling and vibrating to the pitch of the terrain. Barrack had found sufficient blankets to make sitting comfortable, and the broker had taken advantage, curled up like a feline against the cross-legged figure of the sommelier. Waiter, warrior, and concubine? Morgravia preferred not to assume either way, as she regarded her fellow passengers. One of Farkum's courtesans had found a corner to become lost in. She hunched up her knees to her chest and stared at the grubby blankets, perhaps hoping a door would open up inside their folds and let her escape the nightmare. Morgravia sat against one of the flanking trailer walls and looked out into the night, feeling its wintry regard. She tried not to imagine what might lurk beyond her sight, but knew the pallid were but a symptom of something worse, something she had been hunting. She again considered the cause of the plague, the unlikelihood of a pathogen, and the even less probable notion of the taint of ruin. Meager. All of Blackgeist was a faithless place. Any contagion brought about by unbelief and the embrace of the dark gods would have manifested long before now. And the sheer masses infected. It was as if someone had thrown a lever.
"Please?"
a wheedling voice inquired. She looked across the flatbed, irritated to be turned from her thoughts, and glared into the tearful eyes of the scribe. Finely attired, though worn by recent events, he exuded softness.
"I can't do this,"
he said. Morgravia wanted to hit him, but Drover, who had been leaning nearby and smoking a black cheroot, put a reassuring hand upon the scribe's shoulder. "What's your name?"
"Sir."
"What does your mother call you?"
"Oh, Archyle."
"Listen to me, Archyle," Drover said, squeezing a little tighter. "No one wants this, but you're alive. You are doing this. We're all doing this, like it or not."
He paused, conceding, "Mostly not." He smiled then, pulling his punch dagger so quickly that even Morgravia was taken aback.
"I can shorten the experience if you want," he said,
his voice soft, the scribe's eyes widening at the blade suddenly held to his throat.
"It'll be clean, and I promise it won't hurt much. I'm good, real good. I've done it for cattle more times than I care to count. Not a one of them ever made a peep."
"Would you like me to snuff you out, quiet and gentle like? I'd do it quick. A little pain, a little heat, a little cold, and then..."
He made a flourish of his other hand, then put a finger to his lips.
"Is that what you want?"
Archyle stared. He stared for so long, unmoving, that Morgravia began to think his heart might have stopped. But then he shook his head. A slight movement, a near imperceptible gesture.
"So you're doing this," Drover confirmed.
Archyle nodded.
"Don't make us have this conversation again," Drover warned. "And if you refuse to fight when you need to fight, I will slit you open from neck to nethers and leave you to bleed out with your guts round your ankles. Understand?"
Another nod, shallower than the preceding one. The eyes widened further. Drover leaned back, sheathing the knife and gesturing to the ruins of the town with the glowing ash of his cheroot.
"This here is shit. It's as shit as it gets. We are nostril deep in it, so we ain't got no choice but to suck it up. And there ain't no way out we don't make for ourselves. And that is a..."
He stopped, wrong-footed by the courtesan springing to her feet and leaping onto the cabin.
"The hell?"
She crawled, half slid, and threw herself under the wheels.